Kenny, who's going to give us an overview of what we're hoping to accomplish this morning in one order.
Well, good morning, everyone. We have a few papers to discuss this morning on revenue recognition. All of these papers have to do with how much revenue an entity would recognize when a performance obligation is satisfied. So we will start with paper 10A on collectibility, and this is the paper we were discussing on Monday, and there were a couple follow-up issues, so we have prepared a handout to continue that discussion. So each of you should have received a one-page handout front and back. Glenn will take us through that in a moment. After that paper, we'll go through papers 10C, D, and E. All three of those papers have to do with uncertain consideration. And then after discussing that bundle of three papers, we'll then discuss the final paper, 10F, on allocation. So a lot of great topics today, and let's go ahead and get started. So I'll hand over to Glenn, who will take us through the handout on collectibility.
Thanks, Kenny, and good morning, everyone. So, as Kenny mentioned, the handout you have in front of you builds on agenda paper 10A, paper 140A. And in sort of preparing this handout, we've assumed that approach A, which we discussed in that paper, is off the table. So, in other words, we wouldn't be measuring transaction price and therefore revenue at a credit-adjusted amount. Rather, we would be proposing that transaction price and revenue is measured at the amount of promised consideration, i.e. the invoiced amount. So really what we want from this quick discussion is decisions from the board on two issues. Firstly, whether credit risk should affect whether a contract exists or whether the entity recognises revenue upon transfer of a good or service. So in other words, do we need a specific revenue recognition threshold for collectability? The second issue which we're seeking the board's views on is how to present the impairment loss. Whether that presentation of the impairment loss should be adjacent to revenue, i.e. as contra revenue, or alternatively as an operating expense below the line. We've also prepared an example overleaf, which sort of illustrates those differences. So I guess just looking at the table, we've sort of identified there's three steps to apply the model. The first step is to evaluate whether a contract exists. And as you can see there, we've got the criteria for when a contract exists. And there's four criteria. So the first question for the board, and we can talk about the example in a little while, is whether a customer's ability to pay the promised amount of consideration should affect whether a contract exists. In other words, whether we should include a criteria for the customer has the ability to pay.
Thanks, Glenn. Philippe?
Thank you, Leslie. I'm going to tee off. I have a question to the staff about the contents of this first criteria, the contract as commercial substance. And I'm wondering whether the ability to pay is not implicit in the notion of contract having substance, commercial substance, or whether we need that criteria to be separately expressed. I don't think so. I don't think we need it. If a company enters into a transaction which has commercial substance, it seems to me that would be implying that the company has done whatever due diligence it needs to do before entering into this transaction. Due diligence includes determining what are the goods or rights to be transferred, of course. You need to know what is the contract. You need to have some degree of satisfaction that you can perform and also that your customer is committed. Otherwise, there is no contract. If the customer is committed, does that imply that there is at least a certain degree of satisfaction that it's not a phony transaction, that there is something behind that, and that this customer has at least a sufficient ability to pay? You can never be sure about the ability to pay. You can always have that surprise. But it seems to me that that would normally be part of the commercial substance criteria to have at least a certain degree of satisfaction as to the ability to pay. So I don't think we need to make it a separate criteria. But Does the staff, can staff explain whether this definition of commercial substance is the right one, or is there something else there?
I think in part the commercial substance, we did feel at the time we were sort of putting the criteria together when we discussed this with you last month, that we felt that in addition to whether the contract has commercial substance, we wanted to reinforce that there must be the parties to the contract have the intention and the ability to complete their respective obligations under the contract. So I guess we saw it as being similar, but we wished for there to be almost an additional set of criteria to apply as well. Kenny or Henry, I'm not sure if there was anything you wanted to add there.
No, I agree.
I'm peeking a little bit. I've been looking at this thing. In scenario two, where you say recognition hurdle not met, why do you have 1,000 allowance when the probability is 30%? It would seem to me recognition hurdle not met, I don't have a contract. I did transfer goods. I would have thought that I would look at the probability of getting paid and not have a 100% reserve.
Yeah, I think in this scenario, it's assuming that there is a valid contract, so that in the fact pattern we state that there is a valid contract, so it's assuming there is commercial substance and all those other criteria are met for existence of the contract. But because the second hurdle, so this is illustrating the consequence of having a revenue recognition hurdle in step two in the flowchart on the previous page. So if there is this revenue recognition hurdle that is not met, but the contract exists, then we're illustrating that a receivable would exist, but because no revenue would be recognized, it would be offset completely by the allowance.
This is almost like a cash basis.
Yes.
That's right, yeah. It's a net nil receivable.
But in this example, there's a 70% probability that you will get paid.
Correct.
And we're saying no revenue.
Yeah. This is not necessarily what staff is recommending, but this is illustrating what would happen if the boards choose to have some hurdles, such as reasonably assured, in step two on the flowchart. I guess scenario one, just to be clear, yeah, scenario one and scenario two, these are really the board's alternatives here.
I pulled out my business law book last night, which had about a half an inch of dust on it. But just to refresh my memory of the elements of a contract. And ability to pay is not one of them. In other words, you presume that you have willing parties entering into an arrangement and they both assume risks. And the risk of the seller includes the ability of the party to pay. Thinking about this, I'm a little bit concerned about us introducing a criterion into the existence of a contract that does not exist, at least in U.S. commercial law. And I don't know if that's common around the world, but the elements include things that would call into question whether you had a contract are need a contract, whether you're a minor, things like that, not your ability to pay. So I guess my point is that if we want to introduce a notion like this, I don't think it should go into whether you have a contract. It seems to me it might be an accounting notion of whether you should recognize revenue.
But isn't it contained in what Philippe just said, the commercial substance?
Yeah.
I would implicit. Think it's implicit in that.
It's implicit.
But that's Leslie's. Unless I'm wrong, I think that's Leslie's point, is you're presuming something exists that doesn't exist in contract law, at least in the U.S. That's
right.
Your point.
Right.
So therefore, if you want that hurdle, the implication is you need to add it. Can I? When I look at this, I kind of evaluated against two of the situations that we discussed the other day. One is for the healthcare industry. Another one is for the timeshare transactions. And I guess when I evaluate the the scenario where you don't add in the ability to pay, excuse me, for healthcare, I think you need to evaluate who your transaction is with. So if you're a person who doesn't have the wherewithal to pay, effectively, I think your contract is with the government, and Medicare will take over. And therefore, I think it's appropriate for revenue to be recognized, except at the Medicare reimbursement rates, not at the RAC rate, like Tom explained. But then I look at the healthcare timeshare, and that's where I start getting a little concerned, because to the extent that people or companies are entering into these transactions, not really worrying about the creditworthiness of the customer because they always get the property back and can resell it, that causes me some concern. And I don't know if we need to put an ability to pay notion for that to cover that type of a contract.
Tatsumi?
Thank you. So the question for the both, my answer is the first one is no, second one is no, the third one is below gross margin. That is my view. And especially my trouble is by looking at the overleaf, so scenario one, even in this case, the contra revenue of 300 worries me a lot, because I would like to have a gross margin. So by having this contra revenue, the revenue line becomes a net of the collectability. So that worries me. So I would like to see the sort of the gross margin. So therefore, it should be shown below gross margin is the best way. And in addition to that, in case of receivables, we recognize as part of contra revenue. But in case of loans, we show the uncollectability below the gross margin, I think. So the same collectability reflects in two places. One is contra revenue, and the other one is as a expense and below the gross margin. So I'm not quite sure why we need such a separate presentation for uncollectability. So with that reasons, I do not support scenario one, and in the last one, it should be shown below gross margin.
That's a week. I'm not fully following. Can you repeat again about the loans in this revenue?
In case of loans, uncollectability should be shown, as my understanding is, as part of the administrative expense, part of that. That means below the gross margin, I think. But in this case, just receivables related to the sales or providing services. If we take the adjustment to revenue approach, it should be shown just the revenue and then deducted from revenue, and net revenue has been shown. So in that case, only receivable is uncollectability related to receivables is now net of revenue. Let's say if I make a loan, that uncollectability is shown in different place in the income statement. I think I'm not quite sure why it is necessary.
I think the board already decided to follow, bifurcate, or not, the decoupling approach. Then, as I understand, board will adopt approach different from what you described. Mm-hmm. I'm not sure whether I think in terms of interest revenue, we will start the contract amount and deduct it by the possible credit loss.
Yeah, it could be deducted from interest receivables, interest received, but still we haven't discussed the presentation matter.
Sorry, can I just clarify one point? Just on scenario one, where we've got the contra revenue line, we're not trying to sort of prejudge anything there. So that links to the third box, the third question for the board. So perhaps we should have put some more words around that, but we're sort of saying either that 300 gets presented adjacent to revenue, but not as a negative revenue in the revenue line itself, or the decision is as Tatsumi would prefer it, it is presented below gross margin as a separate item. So the revenue will be 1,000, it's just by contra revenue, either this separate line that's adjacent to revenue or as a separate line further down the income statement.
Yeah, but clearly, even adjacent to revenue, but my understanding is that there is a revenue and the collectability and net revenue is shown, I think. And cost of sales comes
after. That's right, yes. That's
after
right.
And the reason that the staff would recommend presenting it adjacent to revenue, and yes, because there are those two line items at the top, it would have a net revenue figure. But we're recommending that because we do have a core principle of the revenue model that says the amount of revenue recognized should be the amount that the entity expects to receive from the customer. So in this scenario, we would say the customer expects to receive, or the entity expects to receive 700, so the net revenue should be the 700, and that's what we propose in the exposure draft, but response has overwhelmingly said that there's tremendous value to showing the grossed up figure, which is why we're also recommending grossing it up.
Kenya, I understand. Say, what I'm suggesting is different from what we exposed.
Yeah. Yeah. Okay.
So to summarize, if I can, Kenya, on scenario one, you weren't intending to prescribe the classification of that contra revenue entry. It could go, if you wanted to, netted against revenue, but it could go to bad debt expense.
Absolutely.
Okay. All right, thanks. Okay, so I've got a few people coming in. Tom, Philippe, and then Patrick. Welcome, Pat.
I agree with Tatsumi on the first two questions. I really don't believe that we ought to, consistent with what you said, Leslie, redefine what a contract is. So I don't think that there should be a customer having the ability to pay indicating existence of a contract. I also don't think that we should have a hurdle on revenue recognition. I find it bothersome that the entries in Scenario 2 don't seem to make much sense to me whatsoever. I do believe that if there are individual contracts, that there are individual rights, and the decision as to what about an uncollectability isn't about individuals at that point. We don't know which ones are going to be the ones that don't pay. It's more of a portfolio notion that we have 30% don't pay. So I think, you know, you have accounts receivable, I think you have revenue. If we go to Larry's timeshare circumstance, I think you have contracts with those people. I think there's significant percentage that won't pay, and that's part of your business model, and that you ought to have revenue that's a possibility from them, but then why I prefer a contra revenue is when you get into those circumstances, a contra revenue that's adjacent to the revenue account, I prefer that if you're really in those high uncollectible settings, that you be reflective of the fact, let's say 30% don't pay the timeshare. I'd like to see revenue at 70%. Because that's the business model. Now, if it's far less, obviously that doesn't feel quite the same, but we are going to be in situations where there are significant amounts. And I'd rather have 70% there than have it 100% in the timeshare setting, because there's individual contractual rights, and then slip down 30% to bad debts far below. I also like it adjacent to revenue because of some of the circumstances that we talked about last time, in healthcare or other settings, and where you don't, it's really hard to tell whether it's a discount or whether it's a bad debt on the time that you contract. And if we're going to put the discounts net of revenue, I'd rather have the bad debts as a separate line item. I think we should be reflecting that, as they told us, but have it adjacent to revenue because of the slippage between those two amounts, rather than put the pressure on having to measure precisely what the discount is and precisely what the bad debts is, and I think we put far more pressure on that when we split it.
Thank you.
Yeah, well, just Tom, just pronounce the Holy World business model. And I think that's it. If your business model, time sharing, that you expect that overall 30% of the clients will not pay, then probably your revenue is at 1,000, it's 700. Now, in most cases, most companies expect most of their customers to pay, and to pay 100%. They have bad surprises, they know that can happen. In those cases, I think it's an expense. It's a bad debt expense. But it's a totally different business model from the one we're discussing time sharing. If you know in advance that
person what would you do?
Don't know which one, but...
What would you do for the time sharing?
I do what Tom said. Contra entry, well, just after revenue deduction. Contra revenue. And then I will show a net revenue after taking into account this percentage that you expect we never pay. But it's social expectation. It's a key word. It's a business model tells you, I expect I will not be paid. In most business models, you expect to be paid, but you just have that surprise.
So to understand you, you're saying this is an option based on your business model?
I would not call it an option. I would call it a translation of the business model. No option, no free choice. If your business model is such that you will not be paid in certain cases, because, and you know it in advance, and you accept that risk, you probably charge a price for that. And that's a banking business model. You have a loan, you know there is a percentage of customers who will not pay, and you charge a premium on those loans. But most companies do not charge a premium for credit risk. They have a catalog price. They don't have a specific premium. Then the expense, well, the bad debt is an expense.
Patrick?
Thank you. I'm completely in line with Tom's analysis. The only thing I wanted to add is I think it's very important, frankly, to have this impairment loss presented adjacent to revenue, because as I've mentioned on several occasions in the past, while I know this project is not about margins, margins cannot be separated from revenue analysis, and that's really where it begins and ends for a lot of people assessing the quality of revenue and the quality of earnings. So if you put this adjustment below gross margin, you're going to goose the gross margin and I think give a misleading picture.
For the record, Leslie, I also agree with Tom's analysis.
Okay, thank you. Russ?
What I hear from this discussion is that everybody believes to do financial reporting, you've got to consider the customer's ability to pay. Whether you consider it in the gross line or the net line. To me, I think we ought to be clear that you must consider the customer's ability to pay. So I have a question to those of you that are supporting Com and then to the users to help make my decision. Where would you put subsequent changes to that allowance? Would you put it in the revenue line item or would you put it below the line? Those of you that are supporting Tom.
I would clearly put it along with near revenue, wherever we get geographically.
Right, in the separate line.
It's just a change in estimate from my perspective.
Okay. The reason I ask the question is if you were to put it below the line in bad debt expense, that would be the subsequent changes, we're going to have the same amount whether you consider the ability or not. And so what my question is do you view a distinction between the original estimate, the original analysis of what you think you're going to collect, and then subsequent changes? And what I hear is you're saying no.
No, in fact, today what many analysts try to do is take the bad debt expense and try to figure out how much to analogize of sort of what should have been maybe perhaps failed sales to begin with.
Yeah. And there's always a lag effect, and you have to think about, okay, I recognize revenue today, this quarter, and recognizing a cost to bad debt subsequent quarter, and I've got growth in sales. How am I lining up those two items? I mean, that's part of the art, if you will, of analysis.
So in that scenario, what does the gross revenue, it sounds like you're analyzing on the net revenue. What does the gross revenue number tell you? Best case scenario?
It's a volume, I think, as BK said. Yeah.
Yeah. Relevant volume. You don't expect to be paid. So what does it tell you? You've already said that what you expect to get paid is a net number. That's what you're focused on. Why do you care what the invoice price is? It's not what's not going to turn into cash.
I care what the invoice price is because I want to get a sense of discounting. If I know I sold 100 units, and we talked about this last meeting, I sell 100 units first quarter and 100 units the second quarter, but I see a difference in revenue amount, gross revenue amount. What's going on? Are there more discounts? Are they dropping price? What are they doing in terms of strategy?
And if the bad debt changes over time, you know that you're selling to a different quality of customer, perhaps.
And we talked about that. You're starting to stretch. You're doing something different. And I go back to, in fact, if I may go back to Leslie's comment about pulling a contract law book out, if we truly are going to stick to that, all that's required in a contract, along with offer and acceptance of legal capacity, is consideration, identifying what the consideration is. And there is no discussion about that. And I think from an analytical standpoint, that helps me because I understand what their strategy is. In the implementation of that strategy, they want to sell to more deadbeats going forward. Fine. I want to know that, though, and I want to have that number carved out separately.
Okay. I've got a number of people who'd like to speak. Let's try and keep it incremental in the scheme of trying to get through some of these other memos. Weiguo?
The other first question is I prefer to...
Can you tip that up? Actually, move the mic. Thank you.
I support to have the criteria the customer has the ability to pay and follow what Philip just described, you know, based on the business model. I think it is quite important. And then the last question is I prefer I think attended three yesterday, actually, he have a contract, the contract lines just right after revenue number.
Mark?
Nothing incremental.
Okay. Well, I will, of course, call for views. Alan?
Not incremental.
Okay, thank you. PK?
I like the way the conversation is going, contract revenue, so I just don't want to say. But to the Russ point, which I agree with him, if for example, I sell to Henry, it's not a deadbeat this time, it's a good fellow, and just say that maybe Henry would be uncharitable, so I'll just say to somebody I sell it, 2 months later, his factory burns down, completely gutted, and there's no ability to pay. It's an event subsequent to the transaction. Why would that be shown under the revenue line item? And that's a pure bad debt. So the reason I'm saying is that I think we will get some pushback in my mind, and I'm not trying to rally the crowds who are listening to this, but I feel that we will have some pushback because I think there's a difference of a financial asset getting impaired, and the expects to pay, this is where I get hung up, which I think I have problems with names. Kenny just mentioned, expects to pay is a day one issue.
Yep.
Anything subsequent to that, I don't know. I'm all the way there to put it as a contra revenue. I'm not an analyst, so I apologize for my ignorance, but all I'm trying to say is that the expects to pay is where I get hung up on. So on day one, you want to show contra revenue. I think I'm liking the way this conversation is going. But subsequent, I just feel that I think we need to test it out to see whether that has any appeal. And I have a lot of respect to the users on this table, so I'm not trying to put them down. But we need to have a wider outreach on this issue.
Well, let me just add to this example. So say I performed last period. And so my revenue went through last period's line, and I had every expectation you were going to pay. I get to the next reporting period, and it becomes uncollectible. I think this model would say, put the debit to bad debt expense up against current period revenue.
Yes, that doesn't make sense to
right.
me.
And then you'd have an allowance against the financial receivable
yes.
on the balance sheet.
Yeah.
That was actually the basis, PK, for what was proposed in the exposure draft. As you said, that at the time of the exchange, expected amount, so that should be the revenue. Anything that happens subsequently would be an impairment of effectively
financial assets
to be received in exchange. But again, this was something that was, you know, we did get 1,000 comment letters commenting on that, and almost all of them said that they did not find it useful to have different presentation of the initial assessment from the
That was my dialogue with Al.
No, Ken, as I said yesterday, you know, after day one, can you trace back, you know,
yes.
Transaction by transaction?
Yeah.
I don't think so. I think, you know, the overall revenue recognition model plus bad debt expense recognition models, I think we should look at the principles from the, even though we recognize individually, but we should look at the whole pictures from, you know, portfolio angles, just like Tom described it.
I actually like Tom's model a lot, this proposal. I think there are there are some aspects of it that are not ideal, as PK just pointed out, but yet I think we can probably address those through possibly disclosure or what have you. I think we will need a certain amount of implementation guidance. For example, the bad debts that are truly bad debts, I think we need to, if we're going to make a decision, I think we need to say that you should follow the impairment model that we're in the process of developing, because that, if the bad debt is related to creditworthiness, we need to tell people how to do it or at least lead them in the right direction. I think the model also takes care of the fact that people, to the extent that you have relatively small bad debt expense, you don't have to worry about what the source is, because typically the source of that bad debt expense it is varied. You know, there are some related to creditworthiness, some related to problems with the product and reductions in prices or returns or what have you. So there's a whole multitude of things that are in there, and I think ultimately it's somewhat of a simplification, but to the extent that it's a fairly big number, people can deal with that in disclosures as to what the sources of that contra revenue number is. So I think it's actually pretty good.
That's it.
I just want to ask the question to Hal, why the top line is important. I think that the top line should not be affected by the collectability, because the entity provides goods or sales goods or providing services. That volume of the entity's activities should be shown on as a top line, and uncollectability should be shown separately. Otherwise, it's a commingled. That's my worry. So I know it's against what we proposed in the exposure draft, but by reading the comment letters, I think that to show the top line is more important. And how to show the uncollectability, there are two ways. One is if we have a contra revenues, as PK pointed out, we have subsequently we have some troubles or some counterintuitive results. But if we put it into the as part of the administrative cost, also the say our proposal in ED is at the inception it's a deduction of the revenue, but the day two we should recognize as part of our administrative cost. It's inconsistent. So in order to be consistent, so either way, we have some troubles, it seems to me. So, but my point is that it seems to me to show the gross margin is more important to show the profitability of the entity's activities. And to collect the cash is it seems to me a different activity of the entity. So it seems to me to separate these two activities more present entities' activities faithfully. So that is the reason why I support the after the growth and gross margin it should be shown.
I mean I agree with the way the conversation's been going. I have difficulty with this position in the income statement, because conceptually I think the initial estimate should go against the revenue and then the change should go lower down. I think that's the best approach. I know everybody, most of the commentators don't like it. So which bit do I move where? And I have difficulty because I think there are advantages of both of the two methods. So, I mean, I could accept either. I think on balance, I think I'm going to change to putting it, as Tom says, up against the revenue. I think perhaps that's the best of the two approaches. But as I say, I could live with either. I wanted to make a couple of other comments. The bit about the discounts in the second question, I think we need to be clear that it's both explicit and implied discounts that's there. I think we need to be, a lot of the problems that we've been having would be dealt with by that. In the last of your boxes, on the left-hand side, you're heading after the good or service is transferred. Why doesn't that say upon transfer? It seems to me that it should be at exactly the same time. I think putting it after is leading to could lead to some confusion.
Wait,
both it says that.
Yeah, he's saying combine the two rows.
Yeah. I'm saying it should be the same.
I think that's fair. Yeah, it's sort of, I guess it does imply a time lag between the actual operational aspect of delivering a good or service and the financial reporting that comes behind it. Close the book, so to speak. But yeah, we can clarify that.
Okay. And lastly, just on Larry's timeshare, wouldn't this be dealt with through returns rather than through credit?
It's both. The customer defaults. I think it's a valid question.
You could attribute it to that. They return the thing.
But it's discounted credit and returns in credit.
But my point is, it's not all a bad debt.
Right. Yeah. Mm-hmm. I'd really like to bring this to a close, and I've got a couple of people still in. Is the questions directly related to this?
No, but I want to ask in a barter transaction how to do that, but this is something we can pick up later.
Sure, Dean. I mean, I think ideally, I kind of agree with Stephen. There's merits to both presentations above and below. I think on balance, I'm going to agree to put it above, in part because today the issue is you don't have any visibility into the day one decision, because one of the top four criteria in recognition at all today is collectability has to be reasonably assured. So if we remove that sort of hurdle, I don't know what that impact is going to be, because I haven't had any visibility into that today. So that says on balance, I want to bring it up just to make sure that I at least get visibility into what the net revenue is, the amount that I expect that the customer is going to get. I think that, ideally, subsequently, I would love to be able to track, as Wei Gu has said, how much of that revenue, how much of that uncollectability is related to this period, and how much of it is related to prior. I know I'm not going to be able to get that, and we'll just have to rely on trend analysis over time to try to make some assertions. And I'm sure that if there's any material things going on where it is truly not necessarily a revenue-related item, but a customer bankruptcy, et cetera, companies will have every incentive to make that pretty clear to people that you shouldn't be looking at it as anything about recurring revenue streams going forward. The only other point I want to make is I sort of implied this on Monday. Ideally, I wouldn't just highlight the visibility about credit in this contra revenue line. There's other things that are going on contra revenue as well that I used to like to get, trying to get visibility on reserves for returns, discounts, etc., which the analysis, the usefulness of the analysis is the same thing as was being described before. Am I changing the base of customers that I'm looking at, customer credit? Or am I doing more discounting to try to understand, or am I thinking that more of these goods are going to come back by a quality issue? So ideally, I would want to expand this kind of thing, this kind of analysis, but I'll live with where I'm at today.
Right. That screams for a roll forward, as far as I can see, but then you're not going to the extent that you load up that number with all these different kinds of adjustments, you're not going to be able to tie it back to the balance sheet, to the bad debt allowance. Just
an implication,
potentially.
Hal? I was just going to see if I can summarize it from a user perspective. The gross revenue is the quality of the product, and I guess in the pricing and everything, and the net number is the quality of the customer when it overlays against the the quality of the product itself. So that's the way I think about it and why you want those two closely related. The second, and several people come in on timing, it's not perfect putting a loss in your facility and having it 6 months later. But think about the metrics that you can and have been for a long time, day sales and receivables, mapped against losses, and you can start to do the analytics even today, and if we can get some roll forwards and other things in there, that would be just, even better. So I think that we can solve these minor weaknesses in this existing proposal.
Can I ask one follow-on to that? I understand your point about the top line is the quality of product and then bad debt is the quality of customer. But if you start giving sales price discounts and you bundle that into this, you'll never see what the quality of product is.
Well, and we can sit there and debate all day, but that's where the analysts come in and really challenge the companies. I don't think we're going to be able to capture this in an accounting standard. I think this is more going to be developmental practice and questions asked.
But the point I'm trying to make is that if you're trying to differentiate between the quality of product and the quality of the customer, why do you allow both the quality, important aspect of the quality of the product and the quality of the customer to be lumped together in a discount? It seems like you would argue adamantly that the top line number has to be gross less discounts than bad debt expense, not discounts within bad debt expense.
If I could get there, that would be great.
That's an issue for another day, the discounts. Yes, John.
Sorry to do this. I know you want to call for a vote. Is it not possible to break this up? Thought of it. In terms of, I've got an expectation, given my history of sales, that I'm going to collect X amount. Timeshare, it's going to be smaller or bigger loss. You put that as a separate item with revenue. Now you have a reserve relating to that. But in subsequent periods, everything else is below the line. So to the extent your estimate changes in terms of what your expectation is on sales, you capture that above, the rest of it below. Have you thought of that?
Would that be done mechanically? Remember we tried to expose that as part of financial statement presentation, the distinction between your day one estimates and your subsequent, and people said that it's not crazy.
And we did it in the EDN revenue,
yeah.
And they said don't do it.
Yeah.
Oh, I thought the problem, though, was we netted it.
Yeah.
But FSB is not just it's an implication.
Leslie?
Yes?
I just wanted to observe, to that observation that was just made. There's a comment in the paper that is alluded, that comes from a comment letter, 967. And it refers to separate disclosures of initial expectations of credit losses plus changes in expectations are necessary for users to have transparency into total credit losses. I remember when we started doing the initial outreach on the loan impairment project here at the ISB that this was a concept or an idea that many sell-side and buy-side analysts hammered home to us and that they wanted to know what the initial estimates of losses were as well as the subsequent adjustments. So to PK's request for additional outreach, I think we've already heard that loud and clear, frankly, in that project.
Is another implication of where this is going that customer receivables have to be in the scope of the impairment document? In other words, I thought at least the ISB had planned to put that aside. But I hear you saying that this number needs to be an expected loss number, not an incurred loss number. So I guess I would just raise that as a possible implication.
We do plan on coming back next, whatever the board's decided, we'll come back next month just to explain how the scope works out.
Tony and Mark, or Warren and Patrick, your name tags are a bit confusing for people who are observing our meeting. Can you check that you have the proper name tags? Or?
Just turn them inside out. Let's try and wrap this up. So I'm going to put the three questions sequentially. The first being, I did not hear support for including a threshold of whether the customer has the ability to pay in the description of the existence of a contract. Does anybody disagree with that So, sorry, let me be clear. Does anybody think we should add a threshold to the existence of a contract condition? No. Okay, we have a so-so vote, but generally not. As far as whether we would have an explicit accounting threshold for whether you have to evaluate the customer's ability to pay before you recognize revenue upon a transfer of goods or services, who would disagree with the staff recommendation not to include a threshold? In other words, who thinks we should have a threshold? IASB?
Come on, BK.
My only point is that for this decision that we have moving towards, and I think reading the discussion, how do you anchor that decision in one of the two boxes? That's the question I have. Or do you straight away go to the third box to anchor it? Now, this decision, I'm prejudging the vote, but let's say, where do you anchor it? Where do you house it?
Okay, you're going to wait until I get to the third vote. You still have a question, then we'll come back.
Okay.
FASB, by the way, that was zero on the IASB. FASB, who thinks we should have a threshold for ability to pay in the recognition of revenue? Okay, that's zero. Going to the third issue, as to the presentation of your expected losses, your impairment losses on the customer's ability to pay. I'm going to scope this to expectations of losses relating to contracts with customers. In other words, things in the scope of this standard. Okay? Who believes that we should present that amount adjacent to revenue, not as a separate bad debt expense line below the line of all other forms of bad debt expense? So IASB, who supports presenting this amount? What's the matter?
Day one or day two? Day
one. You said within the scope of this standard. That's ruling out the impairment thing?
No. I'm saying all we're talking about is uncollectability of contracts with customers under the revenue standard. It is not prejudging how you would present bad debt expense in any other scenario.
That's what I was
saying. Okay.
Day one.
That's day one.
Day one first. So I'm not intending to draw that distinction right now.
You have to.
Yeah, I think
you have to. If you scope out the impairment thing, and you only talk about the expected revenue, which is a concept that Kenny is, that's the day one issue.
Yeah, it's necessary.
So for example, I would support, if we're going to do this, I would put all of it up against the revenue line.
Yeah,
is that where most people are, or some people are saying you would put the day one up against the revenue line and the day two changes below the line?
Yeah, that was my question. I think some people believe that.
I would agree with John's comments. I would agree with that.
Okay. All right. So
I don't know if you. I think you could do it.
I said that.
Okay, John.
Help me understand why you would do it.
John, this is exactly the question we faced and we tried to solve for the open portfolios.
I think there's a difference here, and the difference is these are receivables. These aren't something that's going to last for 30 years. The closed portfolio was a problem because of the length of time they'd be outstanding. It just seemed to me that...
Depends. Some of them can be long-term.
But it just seemed to me, if my expectation is I'm going to lose 10%, that would be above the line. I'd have a reserve related to everything that's outstanding at that level, and then I'd run my reserve the normal way. I think that's more information.
I think the theory about why you might, and I'm not saying this is the way I'll vote, but the way you might want to have initial within revenue and subsequent out is if you really think you ought to focus on net revenue will be based on the ability of the customer to pay. That model will get you there. The initial, what you actually think based on facts when you sell it, what you think you'll collect is in revenue. Subsequent changes are not within revenue.
Yeah.
I think that's a reasonable view to consider. Okay,
so if I think about the way most consumer products companies estimate bad debts on sales with customers, they do a historical loss rate and they put it up as an allowance against receivables. What's the difference between initial and subsequent?
The difference here is that your top revenue number is going to be what you invoice. So I could sell something to somebody and I think there's a 5%. Okay.
What's the adjustment?
The adjustment is that there's been a subsequent change because Henry's factory burned down. Do I want that in revenue?
Do I want the subsequent bad debt that I never expected to happen to reduce revenue 2 years after the product sale?
Okay, but at the same time, it's I could have a pricing mechanism where, you know, I have a rack rate or standard rate of X that I have used for years, and then all of a sudden I decide to start increasing it by 20%, 30%, and figure, hey, if I can get half of that from the customers, fine. But I won't realize that, or I won't find out about that, whether I can collect that full increase until a year or two later.
All I'm saying is we had a debate about what to do. I think people wanted to vote separate. That's all I was trying to explain, why people might want a separate.
Okay. I thought I was sensing a groundswell of support for putting concerns about collectability adjacent to revenue as a general notion. And then I think there are some who think that you are able to distinguish between your initial expectations and subsequent expectations, that they sometimes had a different character, but sometimes I don't think they do.
Yes.
And so I think that there's more work to be done if we want to pursue that, again, based on the feedback we've already gotten on other projects.
And on this project.
On this project.
We separated in this project,
right.
And they said, no.
You're absolutely right. So,
but was it because we separated or because we netted the first
ball?
Both.
I think it's primarily the netting. Yep.
I think a lot of people said, look, you know, we could live with the net revenue that you had in ED, but for heaven's sake, keep it going consistently afterwards, or keep it all out of revenue and the revenues grow, but just be consistent whichever way
you do. So that's the point. If you do it on an agent, I mean, I don't know how you would necessarily figure out is it day one, day two.
I mean, I think you have to remember practically, you know, a lot of businesses will just put the invoices, the transaction processing will go through, and then you just do, you know, at the period end, a sort of a cumulative reserve against your receivables. So it would be very challenging, I think, to sort of split that initial and subsequent.
Yes. Yeah, so the only thing I want to clarify, add on that, is the feedback was any subsequent increases, so say if I get more cash, they would like to show that as revenue rather than show that subsequent collections as contra bad debt.
So I think I'll tell you this, Leslie. I can live with, like I explained, I would have preferred two lines, but I can live with one line adjacent to revenue. So my first preference is that, but I can easily live with contra revenue.
First I'm going to ask, I'm going to see, does the majority think that it should be one line? And if I don't have a majority there, I'm going to ask a different question. But do the majority think that we should try to distinguish your initial estimate from your subsequent estimate? First, let me say, does the majority think that this amount should go adjacent to the revenue line? IASB? I'm asking, do you think that your estimate of uncollectability should be presented adjacent to the revenue line? IASB?
Next.
Can you keep your hands?
Next to, yes.
Can you keep your hands up and steady?
And we should rule out the two lines first.
Yeah, so I think we should do that.
Well, okay. Two lines first, okay. And then go either.
Exactly.
The
that's why I'm like kind of.
Okay. So who believes that we should have one line for your estimate of uncollectability, not distinguishing between initial and is that what you meant?
Yep.
Initial and subsequent changes in fair value. One line. IASB.
And with disclosure.
I can accept
that.
Oh, is that
Warren? Not Simon. Yet. So I make my read. Sorry, I think I've got Simon.
I can accept it.
Okay, FASB, one line.
Majority. We've got 10. We just need a majority for it.
I don't want discounts in this line.
No, we're not talking about discounts today, and I agree with you.
But that's why you put up a well.
Collectability. So we have seven, is that right? So now I'm going to ask on the IASB.
Six.
I'm sorry.
Yeah.
Okay. IASB, who could live with one line for now?
Yeah, one line.
Almost everyone.
Yeah.
So who could accept an approach where you'd have one line for your estimate of uncollectability?
Warren.
Not Warren?
Warren.
Yes. Sir.
So that's seven.
Still seven.
And that's a majority, and that's all we need to continue the discussion.
Okay.
It's only when we get to a point of actually balloting a document that we need to have the nine.
Okay, thank you. And so...
No, you have to do adjacent.
Alan, I count nine.
Okay. Yeah, me count nine.
I thought that was implicit. Okay. I thought that was explicit in my last question.
Okay.
I said adjacent, and then I said next to.
Okay.
So pass that nine.
Where are
you? Okay. So we have conclusions not in the definition of a contract, no probability threshold, and you would present your estimate of uncollectability on an ongoing basis, next to.
Sorry, that wasn't clear for me. So I withdraw my vote. I'm not in favor of putting that line adjacent to.
Okay.
For me, it's below the line.
Okay.
No, so one line, but below the line.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. That's my view. So I just voted just one line, but yeah. I do not support.
Okay. It. For the record, who believes that it should have been below the line, not next to the revenue line? 1, 2, 3. And 3 on the IASB. Anybody on the FASB? One. Okay. You good?
Yeah.
Okay.
Great. Well, thank you. Please get a decision. Let's move on now to an easier topic of uncertain consideration.
Tongue in cheek.
We've got papers 10, C, D, and E that all relate to uncertain consideration. And this, just to highlight, this first paper, it's not a trick. It is intended to be very quick discussion and hopefully decision. So, and Mike Breen will take us. Go ahead, Mike.
Okay. Thanks, Kenny. Good morning, everyone. Objective 10C is to discuss the accounting for uncertain consideration and specifically determine whether an entity should have a right to that consideration before the entity would measure that right. The exposure draft, for uncertain consideration or variable consideration, the exposure draft noted that an entity would recognize revenue upon satisfying a performance obligation only if the transaction price is reasonably estimated. Respondents to the exposure draft were concerned that they'd be required to estimate uncertain consideration even if they don't yet have a right to that consideration. So two examples would be change orders in the construction industry and also options for additional goods and services. But the staff don't believe it was the board's intention to require an estimate of uncertain consideration for change orders and options. And in those situations, we believe it's a recognition issue as opposed to a measurement issue. So that brings us to sales-based royalties. And respondents believed or thought that sales-based royalties were similar to options because the customer is not obligated to make an additional payment until the customer performs some specific action. So in other words, the customer can avoid paying an additional amount of consideration, then the customer isn't obligated to make that payment. Respondents are concerned that an entity would be required to recognize revenue for royalties that are based on the occurrence of a future event. So, for example, customer sales of a product that incorporates an entity's intellectual property. The staff thinks the easiest way to deal with sales-based royalties would be to account for the contract as a series of options to purchase additional goods and services. So that would be that we think you would deal with it in right, the right consideration before you actually measure that right. However, the staff is aware that the board made a decision, or a tentative decision, in the leases project related to variable lease payments. And that kind of decision, the uncertainty of future payments is a measurement issue as opposed to a recognition issue. So therefore, the staff recommends that the board addresses the concerns related to royalties as a measurement issue, which will take us into agenda paper 10E regarding the reasonable estimate constraint on the transaction price. So here what we want to do in paper 10C, we just want to understand that the board agreed with the staff's recommendation to deal with royalties as a measurement issue in paper 10E.
I guess what's interesting about this recommendation is that it appears that the staff, well, maybe I'm reading too much, maybe I'm inferring too much in 13, paragraph 13 and 14, but it sounded as if the staff thought that the easiest way to deal with this would have been recognition, not measurement. But because of a decision we made in leases where primarily we might have been thinking about the lessee, we decided to go with measurement. Therefore, you end up thinking about this as a measurement issue. my preference is that if you want to deal with it, revenue recognition is a recognition issue, and we think about it in less. I would rather align lessors with revenue recognition and deal with any resulting asymmetry between lessees and lessors than to hinge a decision in rev rec based on a lessee decision, if that makes any sense. Mm-hmm.
Okay.
Wait,
Wolf?
Now, I find two areas seems contradictory. First, paragraph 6. Again, you say, in other words, the uncertain consideration is a recognition issue rather than a measurement issue. And later on, in paragraph 14, also the end, you say the board decided that uncertainty of future payments is a measurement issue rather than recognition issue. First, contradictory. And secondly, paragraph 6 and 7. Let me start from 7. 7, you say, the final standard should clarify that a right to consideration must exist before an entity will be required to estimate amount of uncertainty. Then in paragraph 6, you say, you know, an entity does not have a right to consideration until a future event occurs. Now, I open my eyes on this part, until future events occurs. I feel, you know, this requirement is contradictory to our decision on the new option and the variable rental payment. In the revenue, in the lease project, the board decides to take into consideration to recognize the new options when there is incentives. And similarly for value payments. So I think follow this paragraph, we should not recognize renew option and the value payment at all, because the future events have not happened yet.
First point I'd make is in paragraph you referenced, paragraph 6, we were dealing with really responds to the ED or the exposure draft and in regards to change orders and also options for additional goods and services. And we were saying you should have a right before you measure that right. So we dealt with it. We think you should deal with it as a recognition issue. Then you move into royalties. And I think, you know, paragraph 13 says that, you know, if we didn't take into account the decision made in the leases project, we think the easiest way to deal with royalties is a recognition issue, where you have to have a right for consideration before you actually measure it.
I think it's a recognition issue, and I don't think we're in the same setting for leases as we are with royalty-based payments. In the lease, there's two counterparties. There's a lessee and a lessor. The lessee has the right to use the property, and when they use it, they have to pay the variable amount. In the royalty-based payments, there's three parties involved. There is the original seller, there's the party you transfer the good to that then sells it to another party. The right to payment doesn't occur until it gets transferred to the third party. So I think it's a rights issue. When it's in the first party, the seller has not been a completion of the transaction to have the right for payment.
Is it any different from a lease based on sales?
In a mall. The lessor.
It's exactly the same.
There's two counterparties in the lease based on a mall.
If your rent is dependent upon sales of the store, I got to come in and buy the T-shirt before you pay the rent to the landlord.
Pay nothing. Okay, let's see. Is that the point you wanted to make?
Yeah,
But the staff's analysis of being consistent with the lease project revolves around the options to renew, not around contingent payments.
Okay.
Well, I think there's a big difference. I think Mark and Tom have hit the nail on the head. For a lessee, you have the option. Okay? So that's a part of that contract. Under revenue recognition, I don't have the right to any royalty until that sale goes through. I think they're very different.
I think the closer analogy in this thing is contingent rent.
Yes.
Yeah. In other words, I have a contract that entitles me to royalties every time they sell a book, right? They may sell no books and I may get nothing, but if they do, I have a right. It's the same thing.
Yes.
Could I ask something?
My buddy
I bought your product.
Yeah.
And I don't have to pay you a dime until I have some future sales. It would seem to me I've got an obligation, and I'd be measuring that obligation. It would also seem to me that if I have an obligation and I'm measuring it, you should have a right that you're measuring as well. So I think measurement is the right answer. I agree that in some cases it might be very difficult to come up with a number, but in other cases it might be pretty easy. So I thought you were leading us down a, is it a reasonable, or can you get a reasonable measurement? And that would lead to, I'm thinking of it that it's not just the lessor side, I'm thinking of it on both sides. And clearly to me, if I bought something and payments that I'm going to make are contingent on revenue, I think I got an obligation.
Well,
I think you'd be out of your mind to sell me something if it was so uncertain that you'd get paid too.
I'm viewing the lease slightly different in that I have the store. I'm using the store. Depending on how much I use it, I have to pay. And so I am doing that. In this circumstance, in the royalty, the third party doesn't have the good yet. And it's not going to occur until the third party has the good, and then it's a measurement issue.
Are you assuming that the good you got is going to be resold?
Yeah, that's the royalty payment setting.
Royalties generally.
No, this is what we're happening here is I'm the seller, I transfer the chip or whatever to you. You're going to put it in your good, in a bigger good, and then you're going to transfer it to a customer. And when you transfer it to your customer, I get paid.
I have no obligation to you until I transfer it?
That's correct.
That's right.
Okay.
It's like consignment inventory.
I would agree with that. If that's what we're talking about.
Well, that's one of the things we're talking about.
There's other royalty arrangements where I pay $1 million fee to Tom. He gives me his code. I take the code, do some other things, and I pay $1 every time I sell my software. That sounds an awful lot like contingent rent in a lessor perspective.
Okay, let me let some others in. Warren?
On Philippe.
Is it the real Philippe? Or
it's my buddy, the one.
Can you speak French?
No, I won't be anywhere near as concise or thoughtful as Philippe, but I'll do my best. I disagree with Tom's analysis. I think that it is a measurement issue. I think the staff, even though sort of they're reluctantly referring us to leases, I think that is the correct analogy. And I honestly don't see the difference, Tom, between a lease arrangement that is dependent upon payments, depending wholly or partly upon use of the asset that you have a right of use in relation to. And let's say it's a retail store and it's dependent upon turnover until someone walks into the store and you actually sell something, you could argue that you don't have an obligation to pay anything. And I think we got over that in leases and said, no, there's a right of use. You have that right from day one, and now we're trying to measure the obligation that we have in relation to the payment for that right of use, and that's also the measure of the asset. And likewise, on the lessor side, I think we were being consistent. I know you have the override in terms of reliably measurable. So I just can't see the distinction that you're trying to make. In the case of the royalty, there's no doubt that the entity that licenses that intellectual property has a right. And yes, until the holder of that license actually employs that and generates income, you could argue that there's no amount that's due. But how is that different from the lessee that has the store open and isn't going to actually receive anything until customers come in and buy the products. I just don't see the difference.
Okay. I start with the notion that this is a measurement issue, but I want to ask staff a question on para 13 just to understand. The staff thinks the easiest way to deal with the usage-based royalty contract would be to account for a contract as a series of options to purchase. By using the word options, I know we don't want to do that, but what are you trying to imply? Do we need to do anything with those options? Do we need to value those options? What do we do? Because if it's a measurement issue, the options cannot be measured. Is that your consideration? I'm not very clear how the para 13 is ending. Could you please help me?
Yeah, I think para 13 was just saying we want to deal with this, or I think the easiest way to deal with this would be as a recognition issue. So it's a series of options, meaning the customer has an option to use the intellectual property so that an entity wouldn't recognize revenue until they have sold to the customer.
An option has a value, right?
We don't mean carry the fair value, do we?
No.
Yeah.
No,
that's what I'm trying to say.
No, we do not mean fair value.
Yeah.
No.
Steve?
Part of my problem with this is I'm struggling to give an answer before we get on to 10E and talk about how to measure. So to my mind, we recognize and we measure based upon some reasonable estimate, or we measure taking into account a contingent revenue cap, or we don't recognize. So I don't think there should be revenue until the next party is sold on. So until you have that right to consideration, whether it's a royalty arrangement, I don't think you should have revenue until somebody's actually done something, sold to a customer. And with contingent revenue, with lease income, which is contingent upon future sales, I don't think you should recognize that as the lessor until the sale has been made. And to my mind, there's two ways of getting there. You do it in recognition, which is the sort of the staff's preferred approach, or you accept that you recognize, but then you deal with it through measurement by applying the contingent revenue cap. So I'm not too fussed, which we have. I'd like it to be consistent across all the projects and whatever works best, but there seems to be two ways of getting to the same outcome.
Yeah, just to clarify, the staff agrees completely. I mean, you can get the same outcome, and I think almost everybody agrees with the pattern of revenue recognition that would be most useful, so it's just a matter of what's the best way to get there. We are recommending through measurement. You know,
But your recommendation in 10E is reasonably estimable, isn't it?
That's right, and that's
not
why
contingent revenue cap.
That's right, and that's why we did acknowledge in this paper that the easiest, the cleanest way to do it would be to simply say that with a royalty type situation, the right does not exist. That's clean. It's easy. We're not saying it's the right concept, but that is the cleanest way to do it. Because in the next paper, when we talk about the constraint, you would effectively have to say that an entity cannot reasonably estimate royalties when responses to the exposure draft suggest that they can at least estimate some, perhaps the next 3 months, the next 6 months. But with some implementation guidance, we think we can make it very clear sort of what the pattern of revenue recognition is. So, within the framework we're creating. But I agree completely. Which approach do you want to take?
So my related problem is what we've done in leasing, which is that we have this recognized contingent rent if you can reasonably estimate it.
Yes.
Which I disagreed with at the time. But we need to line all of these up, is my point.
But the difference between this and leasing is that in leasing, your goal is to present value the expected payments and put it on the balance sheet.
Well, I was thinking of lessor when I was describing that.
Martin, we're talking here about the way Tom described it. I sell something to Tom. You don't have to pay me until you sell that something to someone else. That, to me, is very different than I sell something to Tom. He's got to pay me based on his future revenues, regardless of my product. And I would differentiate those two things, because one, to me, I agree with you, it's a consignment. But the other, I think, is measurement.
And actually, we think if it's dealt with through measurement, it could be done in standard that way, because I think staff would agree that that is different, based on the uncertainty is based not just on the current transaction, but on future transactions with other parties. We could do it that way through measurement.
Most importantly out of this, I would object if we represented that if you write an option, that you don't have a liability. There's not a right associated with a written option. I think there is a right, and I think we just confuse everyone if we don't say that there's an obligation both on the written option, a liability, and if you hold the written option, a right. I think that they exist.
My point.
I don't think we need to call them options, though.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, me too. But my worry is we're going to flip it into options and then say options are not associated rights or obligations.
Warren, did you want to get back in?
Yeah, just very quickly, a point in regard to Stephen's comments. I think, Steve, you were, if I'm not incorrect, I think you were disagreeing with the decision that we've made on leases. Is that correct? I mean, you're expressing a view as to how you would account for this, but
that's right.
Implicit in that is you disagree with what we decided in relation to lease payments dependent upon the use of the right of use asset.
Yes.
Is that correct? Okay.
Okay. In consultation with the staff, we're thinking it's not going to be most productive to call the question as written on this paper. So we're going to move on and discuss the other papers and see if we will address it through those discussions. Okay? So would you guys like to go next?
Okay. So, I think next let's go to the sort of measurement objective, and that's in paper 10D, and Allison will take us through that.
Thank you, Penny. As we mentioned, the constraint on revenue is a separate paper, 10E or 140E, but what we're focusing on now is agenda paper 10D, memo 140D, that addresses the issue of how to measure the transaction price. So we're just focusing on measurement here. The exposure draft proposed that an entity would measure revenue at the transaction price or the amount of consideration that an entity receives or expects to receive from the customer. The exposure draft also proposed that when consideration is uncertain or variable, the transaction price would be measured using an expected value or probability-weighted approach. Feedback from respondents in paragraphs 7 to 11 of the paper indicates that almost all respondents dislike the probability-weighted method for measuring uncertain consideration. And this is because it appeared complex to apply and would create volatility in revenue. A few respondents did acknowledge, though, that it would be appropriate as a measurement technique in some circumstances. Many respondents suggested that instead of a probability-weighted method generally, though, for estimating variable consideration, they should use a management's best estimate. In developing this paper, we considered the cross-cutting issues paper on measuring uncertain cash flows. That's the paper that Joan and Wayne and Jim prepared in February. Using the analysis in that paper, the staff narrowed the measurement models to two models that would provide meaningful and reliable estimates. Those models in paragraph 14 of the paper are the probability-weighted model, which was proposed in the exposure draft, and the more likely than not model, which Joan referred to in her paper as the maximum amount more likely than not to occur. The staff also considered the alternative of management's best estimate, which is sometimes interpreted as the most likely outcome or a mode. In paragraph 17 of the paper, we explained that we rejected this model because the best estimate can be interpreted differently by different people. Additionally, the cross-cutting issues paper outlined a number of cons of the most likely model, in particular that it's a poor central estimate in many cases. The staff observed that in some cases the most likely model may generate the same results as the probability-weighted model and the more likely than not model, and in those cases it may be easier to apply. Should the boards adopt the staff recommendation, we may want to indicate that point. The analysis of the models in paragraph 19 to 38 applies the analysis from the cross-cutting issues paper and illustrates that the most relevant measurement model would depend on the nature of the uncertain consideration being measured. In particular, the probability-weighted method would be relevant for amounts that occur frequently and are homogeneous. On the other hand, the more likely than not model would be relevant for amounts that do not occur often, are heterogeneous and are highly uncertain to be received. We note that these attributes are common to uncertain consideration amounts. Furthermore, applying the more likely than not model may be simpler and more meaningful in many cases, because amounts that are highly uncertain can be ignored in the calculation. The staff recommendation in paragraph 39 is that the boards affirm the core principle of measuring revenue at the transaction price, and in determining that transaction price when consideration is uncertain, the staff recommend that an entity should estimate the consideration at the amount that it is more likely than not to be received from the customer. An entity would apply the more likely than not model in all cases unless the uncertain consideration is frequently occurring and homogeneous, in which case the entity should use a probability-weighted method. Now turn it over to the boards for discussion.
Just want to clarify before we start this discussion, the uncertainty that we're talking about are contractual terms where the amount of consideration would vary, as opposed to uncertainty relating to credit. Right?
Yes, that's right.
Okay, just so we don't have to start that again. Okay. Other questions? Tom.
It's like I feel like we're deja vu all over again.
Exactly.
I believe that the staff has proposed a solution that not necessarily will be fully cost-effective for the problem that was identified. And I think the problem that was primarily identified was this binary circumstance where you could have two outcomes that are widely variant. One could be like at 80% probability, the other one at 20% probability. And people expressing the concern in that wide circumstance to probability weighted and get a number in between that's not remotely possible of occurring, that number is not a good number to be measuring the transaction price at. And as a result of that problem, I think that's what has driven this memo. And to me, I think we have to decide, if you're in that setting, whether we think the mean or probability-weighted cash flow is what we'd like the answer to be. And it might be that we don't think that. We could want the mode to be the answer, that is the 80% one is what we should use. Or it could be that it's the median, the 80% number is the one we use. But I don't think the median is the optimal solution to that problem. Because if we take what we talked about yesterday and multiple times over again now, if we specify a different measurement objective and people take it extremely seriously, you've got to go all the way on the median. And to go all the way on the median, you have to know either the bottom 50% of the distribution completely or the top 50% of the distribution completely to be able to pick a median number. And I think that's not a cost-beneficial way, first of all, necessarily to deal with this one problem. But I think if we go to a median circumstance, we're going to only exacerbate the problem in other areas. Because the other areas were that we don't have a lot of information about outcomes and probabilities. We have a limited amount of information. And saying running to the median so that you must know the top half of the distribution or the bottom to pick the 50th fractile, I don't think is a cost-beneficial solution. I think we could still say, like we did yesterday, the objective is the mean. You don't have to go do a search and destroy mission. Use the outcomes you know and the probabilities you know to come up with a number. Don't have to go further beyond that. And we could decide then, except in the rare circumstances where we've got this binary outcome. And we either can decide in those rare circumstances that we either do the median or we do the mode, but I don't think that we should turn the whole model up for that one problem.
Okay. So I don't accept that was the only problem that was raised.
Okay.
I think it was pointed out a bunch of times to illustrate the point, but I think many, many people expressed concern about the use of probability-weighted cash flows in the revenue line. and that was frequently brought up as the most extreme situation to make the point. But I doubt anything I would say would change your mind about how to proceed, but I just don't accept that premise that was the only issue.
Well, we were even if it isn't the only issue, I think we could agree the median may not be the best way to do it if it requires you to understand fully the top half of the top half of the distribution to come with a number.
In the investor meetings I sat in on, there was concern expressed about frequent adjustments to the revenue line. And now we have no threshold for recognition, so I think we want to think about that. Larry?
I guess the problem that I have is that this memo addresses a myriad of different circumstances where the amount that you're getting is uncertain. And when I was reading the memo and objecting severely to a lot of the recommendations, and then came across the example of the coupons, I thought you had really committed a foul to us, because I wasn't thinking about coupons whatsoever, and I kind of agree. I agreed with your analysis when it pertained to coupons. But when it pertains to, and I think in terms of incentive awards, where I need to complete a job in a specified time period or what have you in order to have an increase in the price that the customer will pay to me, I have a difficult time with what we had in the exposure draft, because I think you can have have the ability to estimate. I could have contracts that are very similar, but yet I only hit that target 10% of the time, and I don't believe that any of that revenue should be recognized until you hit the 10%. Likewise, I totally disagree with the more likely than not threshold that the staff has put into place, because theoretically, you could be reversing out revenue 49% of the time, and I just think that's totally inappropriate. So I disagree with the staff recommendation.
I have to interject one thing. That, to be clear, we're talking about the objective for determining the transaction price. This is the amount that is allocated across all performance obligations, both satisfied and remaining. This is not addressing the constraint on revenue recognition. So the next paper, Larry, I think you'll get a chance to sort of vote on how high of a hurdle you want for the revenue constraint. This is just, what is the objective when determining the transaction price? It affects not just amounts allocated to past performance obligations, but also amounts allocated to remaining performance obligations, which I think we highlight also relates to the onerous test and some other issues. But I think we need to separate the two. What is the objective for determining the price that's allocated across everything? And then we'll talk about how high of a hurdle do we want to constrain what would otherwise have been recognized as revenue.
It would have made some sense to take the next one before.
I think I agree with Larry in some respects that I have some problems with recognizing revenue under those circumstances. However, for measuring the transaction price, I agree with the staff. I think it should be the more likely than not criteria. And I think the cross-cutting paper that we had at the last main meeting, I thought that was excellent, and that clearly pointed us towards using a mean in circumstances where we're trying to get a current value type measure, which is why I think the receivable should be a mean. And I think it pointed towards a revenue recognition type situation being a more likely than not. Now, I can't remember exactly why I reached that conclusion from reading the paper, but that was the conclusion that I got to at the time. Because I don't think that revenue recognition is about trying to measure wealth or current value. I know if we were doing fair value for revenue recognition, it would be a mean. We're not doing that. We're doing a different approach, and I think the more likely than not is the right method. However, I think it should therefore be more likely than not in all circumstances. I don't think there should be a differentiation between a single contract and a portfolio. If for a portfolio, again, from what we were discussing yesterday, for a portfolio, there wouldn't be that much of a difference between the more likely than not median and the mean anyway, so it's probably a bit academic, but I think it should be consistent. However, so that's where I started. But then I got to example two on page 9, and I suddenly started to question my analysis. because in this, we've got the 30% chance of the bonus, sort of the 70% chance of receiving the bonus, and so the more likely than not suggests that we should recognize it. But is this Lowry's point that it's not to do with the measurement of the transaction price, but it's the recognition? Because I don't think that bonus should be recognized until you deliver the goods within the 30 days. So am I thinking of this in the wrong paper, or is this really an issue for the next paper?
I think it's the next paper.
Next paper.
I think it is.
This is determining the price, not the recognition.
Right.
You can constrain
so in that case,
the next happy. Paper or not.
Okay.
You could. I have a lot of sympathy for the comments that were made in this regard and the use of the probability, but we had extensive discussions yesterday, not just yesterday, but more recently yesterday, about this aspect. I think my worry with this is that very few transactions, I appreciate this is only determination of transaction price, but determination of transaction price has a knock-on effect on the when the revenue is recognized. So we cannot just think that it's a determination of transaction price so we can feel good. So we need to think about it because that sets the train in motion in one sense. Coming back to the point I want to make, my worry is that there would be a lot of tension in practice. How frequent is frequent, for example? And people will start gravitating towards more likely than not. I think my suggestion is if somebody can develop these three scenarios, and going to the Larry's yesterday's example of, like you guys were not there, so it's unfair to talk about Larry's yesterday's example. It's not worth talking anyway, but all I'm trying to say, if you have the probabilities, if you have known those things, can you somehow communicate that's enough? Can you do that? Is that a solution we can think about it such that we don't have this cut up or more likely than not in one situation, mean in another situation that would confuse? So I'm just thinking maybe to be consistent with yesterday's decision also, they should know. And I propose could have known, but I will not propose it today. But I'm just saying that might help alleviate the concern out there. And I can tell you that otherwise I think we are going to create a lot of tension about this aspect or how frequent is frequent aspect. But I do have a lot of sympathy for the staff's creativity here, and I applaud them for their creativity. I don't agree, but I applaud.
I also look at this issue from cross-cutting point of view. I don't think we are consistent in terms of discussion over the objective of a measure. You know, yesterday we debate again whether we should strive an objective. And our side, ISB side, as I remember, 15 or 13 people vote for, we should have an objective that is mean.
It's 15.
How many?
15.
15. So you support. But now you say it, not.
No, I'm saying the same thing.
Yeah. Say.
We were saying the same thing. We should have the same objective and should not have this cut between most likely and expected value. We should have expected value in all situations. That's what I'm trying to say.
But at the same time, you say you have a concern.
Yeah. Okay. We can talk later.
Okay. But now what I want to say is, if we agree the objective here, why, yesterday we arrived at a different conclusion, And also, I think we will have similar discussions in the insurance project and these projects and in the future. So the 7th, we have not finalized yet. We will debate again should we have a very general description of the objectives, or the ones like here, we specify, you know, if it is frequent, occurred, or homogeneous, you use probability weighted. Otherwise, use most likely.
I think that is a big if, because I'm hearing people disagree with that. Warren, did you want to get in?
Not just yet, Leslie.
Okay, thank you. Russ?
So when I think about revenue, we're going to have estimates of the volume, because we're going to estimate rights of return. We're going to have estimates about the transaction price, which is to some point this paper. And now within net revenue, we're going to have estimates about credit. I would like as much as possible to have the same estimation methodology within that. I recognize that credit we might want to align with impairment, I understand, but I would want us, or I encourage us, to have the same philosophy on rights of return as well as transaction prices. I'm concerned that if you start changing measurement philosophies depending on if you're estimating volume versus estimating price, and then you're changing philosophies on the types of uncertainty and consideration. When I look at example one, it seems like we want probability weighted because it's going to reduce revenue. When I look at two and three, we seem to say, maybe more likely not as important because it's going to increase revenue. To me, I'd like to evolve around one methodology, and it seems to me it's more likely than not.
Wayne?
I'd like to probe whether or not I understand why people are saying certain things. And I think I want to build on what Steve said. More likely than not, expected value are techniques. They're not objectives in and of themselves. And Steve made the point that if our objective was evaluation of some sort, which is clearly our objective in impairment, that you ought to be expressing the objective as finding the mean because that's most consistent with the valuation notion. When I hear people say, Larry, I think, was the one who said this most strongly, I don't think revenue is like that. Is it because when you're measuring revenue, you're not in the valuation business, but you want a number that is most likely to be predictive of what actually happens? So given the 80 or 20, the 80 is not a valuation, but it is the most predictive because it has the highest probability. So if your objective in revenue is, I want a revenue line that is going to be most of the time pretty close to what actually happens, you've changed your measurement objective. And there's nothing wrong with saying, nothing intellectually inconsistent with saying, because of that, I want to move to something that, for which the best technique is the most. And I think maybe, Tom, that's what you were getting at, too, that if you've changed horses, there's nothing wrong. But it would, I think, be helpful in other projects if we express the decision in those terms, that we pick the technique that is most consistent with what we thought our objective was, rather than doing it the other way around. Because otherwise we just argue over the virtues of a hammer as opposed to a screwdriver. It's not helpful.
Wayne, can I just ask, did you mean mode or median?
I thought when I said it I misspoke, I meant median.
Okay, good.
I thought you meant mode. Because I thought you said what you most likely expect to happen. In other words, mode.
That's mode, yeah. Excuse me, I'm sorry. Yeah.
But in Jones' paper, it says most likely outcome is a poor central estimate of distributions.
That's right, it is. It's a poor central estimate, and if your objective is a valuation of some sort, you want something that is a good central estimate. if you want something that is the most likely to be predictive of the ultimate outcome,
the mode.
Then you want the mode.
And that's where I would have headed. And I don't think it necessarily is more likely than not. Right? Those are not expressing the same thing. Right? You could have a distribution, and then you say, I think this one is most likely to happen, but it may still not be more likely than not.
And Joan and I went back and forth and round on that, and she convinced me that there are situations in which that strange formulation of the maximum amount that is most likely, oh, yada, 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 is not necessarily always the mode. She persuaded me of that.
I mean, I think, if I could just jump in, sorry to cut the line, but I think to jump in on that, like, what people are confusing, or people are combining this memo and 10E, because I think people are thinking about them together, because if the most likely outcome happened to be, you know, if you had four different potential outcomes and the most likely of those four happened to be the one where the most revenue was recorded, I think people would not want the mode in that circumstance. And so you end up with the construction of the maximum amount that reaches the 50% because they're trying to constrain it and come up with this a central tendency at the same time, which is quite difficult.
You can't ride two horses.
Figure out what the transaction. I mean, that's why the staff is trying, and Kenny tries to say, is this is really about figuring out what the transaction price is and try to separate that conversation from the next conversation, which is, well, how much revenue are you going to actually record and book?
Philippe?
I think this conversation around statistics is intellectually very exciting. But let me play for a while and maybe continue to play the role of the conservative old traditional accountant and maybe the old regulator. And let's return, for example, to the bonus at page 9. And let's stress test a little bit this example. Assume that the probability of receiving the bonus is not 70% but 51%. And I would like to ask the user from the table, are you better off with recognizing zero and disclosing the probability, 51% of receiving the bonus, or recording this case 300 revenue and having one chance out of two of having to adjust that in the next period?
Is the question whether I'd rather have 0 or 300 in your example?
Yes, it's between 0 or 100, 51% of receiving 300. So according to the staff, you will record 300 as revenue in this case, because it is more likely than not. You have passed the threshold of 50%. I voluntarily stress tested at 51%, which is your ultimate stress test. But you can go anything down from 70% to 60, 50. So what do you prefer? Disclosure that there is a possibility, maybe more than likely number, of getting something, but keeping that as a disclosure or to recognize with a chance out of two of not having that.
But why couldn't you just say the transaction price is 300, but I'm going to constrain the amount of revenue recognized to the amount that's actually reasonably assured?
Okay, then you need to have another threshold which is reasonably assured, above and beyond this more likely than not. Here, this paper, this is why I said to the staff we should discuss 10E before this one. But let's put aside this 10E paper. If we don't have this additional threshold, then I'm not very happy with this proposal. I say intellectually it's right. I mean, in pure mathematics, pure statistics. I'm not sure accounting is just about statistics.
But going to the Mark's answer, that 300 is a transaction price, I would not say 300 is a transaction price. There's up to 500 is a transaction price. In this example, up to 500 is a transaction price, and you know, I'm more likely than not to get 300 is a thing, but transaction price is not 300 here.
What?
It's up to 500. And you will constrain it. That's a different issue. But the transaction price could be up to 500. And that would be misleading to tell somebody it's 300 and it can go up to 500.
No, why is this example either 0 or 300?
No, no, I'm reacting to Mark, not to you.
Okay, let me bring in the guys in London.
This example, yeah. 500.
I guess I might answer the question the following way. And I go back to observations or comments that Wayne made. And he was suggesting or stating that, if I have this right, the measurement technique can vary depending on what your measurement objective is. And while I agree with that, I guess what I'm saying in this paper here is not necessarily a rigid view on what measurement technique should be required for a specific measurement objective. That the facts and circumstances of a particular uncertainty scenario will kind of drive the statistical technique that you would use to achieve your measurement objective. So where you have large pools of homogeneous types of transactions, they're suggesting that an expected value approach would be most appropriate, and that is supported by the paper that Joan has and others have developed. On the other hand, where that's not the case, another technique may be more appropriate. But that doesn't necessarily mean your measurement objective has changed, in my view. If we're going to say that you can only have one measurement technique for a given measurement objective, I think we are potentially constraining the kind of information that you would want to convey to a user.
Okay, thanks, Leslie. I don't agree with the staff recommendation. I think it should be, the measurement objective should be expected value in all cases. And I think the place we ended up yesterday in relation to impairment is the place we need to be. And I think that was what Tom was explaining at the end of his comments, so I won't repeat them. And I worry about some of the outcomes you get if you use the more likely than not approach. And if you look at the example that's in the paper, yeah, the numbers sort of they seem to be appealing because there doesn't seem to be a substantial difference between the outcomes you might get if you use expected value or more likely than not, although I think PK was pointing to the concern that I have. But if you can just bear with me a minute, if I can just give you another example of this bonus circumstance. So let's assume that the probability of receiving zero was 20%, the probability of receiving 500 was 40%, and the probability of receiving 5,000 was 40%. Now, if I use more likely than not, then I'm going to measure that I think 500, because it's at least a 60% chance that I'm going to be paid 500. If I use an expected value approach, I'm going to measure it at 2,200, and it's substantially different. And I know that the paper points this out in paragraph 31, that the amounts are close to the threshold, they become highly sensitive to changes in probabilities. And I think we can sit here and say, well, you know, maybe we can live with those sorts of outcomes, but there's somebody else on the other side of the transaction, and they're going to measure a liability. And ask yourself, in that example, are you happy for the liability to be measured at 500 and not 2,200? And that's where I have trouble with the analysis that Steve was pursuing, and Wayne for that matter, although I'm not sure Wayne was necessarily supporting it but trying to understand it. I think in the case of the liability, you're probably saying it's a valuation methodology, and in the case of the revenue determination, it's something else. I'm not sure what it is.
So it worries me that you get some outcomes potentially that I don't think are in any way representationally faithful of the transaction price, and certainly wouldn't be, I think we'd all agree, representationally faithful of an equivalent liability measure.
Is this dictating both sides of the transaction?
I think this is a fruitful discussion, and I think we've devolved to deciding how much revenue we want to recognize, and that's not really the purpose of the question. And so if the purpose of the question, it's really deciding what the total transaction price is going to be that we allocate to multiple performance obligations, and then once those performance obligations are satisfied, perhaps the amount after that allocation will recognize as revenue. But when it's variable consideration in those circumstances, the follow-on memo deals with the revenue recognition. So I think that I don't know that we have a huge issue in the transaction price area. Because if we're going to allocate the transaction price by the relative expected selling prices, the transaction price has to be the expected amounts. Or we're going to have an inconsistency between the measures that we come up with a transaction price and the allocation mechanism. It's got to be, if it's going to be expected selling price that we allocate these things over of the total transaction price, it's got to be the expected amounts that we use to get the total transaction price. And I think we could stop there and then move to the next memo, to the concerns about when we have variable consideration, how much revenue we'll recognize in a variable setting. And so if people accept that, I think we stop here. And I don't think the issues we're dealing with here have anything to do with the transaction price and the allocation. It has to do with something else. Because I don't understand, if you look at the example on paragraph 28, the expected selling price is the expected amount is 260. Let's say that was for a separate performance obligation. And we had another performance obligation in the model that was a fixed price of 100. We'd say the total transaction price is 360, and we'd want to allocate to the fixed transaction price 1/360 of the total, and we'd want to take 260/360 to the other performance obligation. We take expected values and allocate it by the expected amounts, and we get the answer we want. But if we change the 260 to something else, we'd have to change the relative allocation to other than expected selling prices to make it work, and I think that's just going to convolute the whole model. So I think we're answering a question that doesn't apply here, and the staff does something different from mean, median, and mode in the next memo about what we're willing to recognize as revenue once we've got the amount identified for variable consideration.
Larry.
I guess I'm getting confused, and Kenny kind of smacked me over the head before when he basically told me that I'm bringing up an issue in the wrong paper. But help me understand. I'm just having difficulty understanding this, even in terms of determining the transaction price. And I'm going to go back to the example that I used numerous times. I'm in the business of selling all of your computer needs to a particular company, and I'm going to be providing help desk type services subsequent to the sale, and I'm also going to install it. Okay, so I'm doing the whole thing, but it's one lump sum price. But in addition to the fixed amount, and let's say it's $1 million, I get an incentive fee based upon, and you can come up with multiple ways of doing it, but based upon the number of help desk requests I handle, all right? And I have a lot of experience with organizations like this, and I'm able to come up with some type of an estimate. I don't care if you use most likely amount or probability-based or what have you, but there's this incentive fee that I'm going to get that's tied to my help desk endeavors.
I'm supposed to use that probability amount to come up with an overall transaction price, which then gets allocated to the individual components? Why?
Well, yeah, first of all, I'm sorry, Larry, I didn't mean to. It wasn't intended to kind of smack.
You can take care of me whatever you want.
No, but I mean, it's, you know, it is true. I mean, it's easy for me to say that, but I mean, it is very difficult to do. I mean, it's not easy to separate all these entirely. And we are trying to, unfortunately, we do have to deal with these sequentially to build up decisions. But I think that's a great example, and you know, it actually does relate. That example does relate to other issues that are coming. That we also have an allocation paper that Prasad will take us through, and in that allocation paper, we talk about ways that you might want to ring fence allocations of discounts and allocations of subsequent changes in the transaction price. So in that fact part, you know, I don't know what the variable fee is per increment of support service, but if that incremental fee is sort of commensurate, or you know, if that part of the contract is priced independently, then you may start to, you know, ring fence some bits of the transaction price. So I don't know if that's helpful or hurtful, because the issues are interrelated. So I mean, as we go through the other papers, hopefully it's more helpful. So I don't know. I mean, I'm thinking about Tom's point. You know, are we ready to move on to the next paper and then try to come back at the end and wrap all this up? I don't know if that's the best technique. But I guess in this paper, one thing I think we do need is kind of an affirmation of the objective. And I appreciate Wayne's comments. I think they're spot on. It highlights the challenge we've had with this issue for as long as I've been on the project, and it's the fact that we've got revenue, but we've also got a performance obligation. And for revenue, people very much want an objective of predictive value, and you know, we talk about, even in this, our first recommendation here, a core principle of the amount the entity expects to receive, that is kind of like a predictive type objective. But of course, the amount of revenue is based on satisfaction of a performance obligation, and the performance obligation, I think some board members want more of a valuation objective, because it is a balance sheet item. And we do sort of have these conflicting objectives that we've long struggled with, which is why we're trying to just say, first of all, can we get an objective for just the amounts allocated? And we are asking, the first question is, do you affirm that the objective is the amount that the entity expects to receive? And we're saying that when it's a probability weighted, or when it's a large pool of homogeneous transactions or, you know, types of uncertainty, we think that, in fact, a probability weighted or expected value technique would be an appropriate way of meeting that objective of the amount that the entity expects to receive. But when the outcome is binary, we don't think it is consistent with the objective of the amount that the entity expects to receive, because it's one or the other is what they expect. So, I mean, I think it would be very helpful if we could just get maybe even a tentative agreement that is our objective, and then we can go on and we'll talk about the constraint. And, you know, even this example in paragraph 28, you know, we highlight that the entity does not have experience with, you know, working some of this, so it's uncertain whether the cost savings will be achieved. That ties in directly to the next paper of whether it can be reasonably estimated. And so, yeah, to be fair to Larry, I mean, it's not easy to separate this entirely, but I think it would be helpful to get at least a tentative leaning on our objective here before we move on.
Kenny, I think I've heard enough diversity of views in this discussion to be concerned that the views you might hear if we ask for leanings are subject to the satisfactory resolution of some of the other issues. And so I'm going to agree with Tom that let's stop this for now, but then circle back at the end after we've gone through some of the other papers and see if people were, just like what happened first thing this morning, people are more willing to think about these issues together and maybe come to some conclusions.
It'll taste better if it simmers. Yeah.
Can you get some fresh air for a few minutes?
You want to take a break first?
Yes.
Okay, so let's take a break till 10:15, and then we'll start on, is it 8:00?
Thanks, Mr. McKinney.